Chapter 38. They found an airlock easily enough, set at ground level. Geoffrey didn't doubt that there was another one situated near the docking clamps for the convenience of arriving ships. Jumai slapped her palm against the green-lit entry panel, and the outer door opened without complaint. The Eisteroid's defences, geared towards the interception of arriving ships, paid no heed to anything happening on the surface. There was room enough for both of them inside the lock, even with their thruster packs. The outer door closed. Air gushed in through slats. "We've lost contact with the ship," Jumai said. "Eunice was right. The airlock's blocking signals." When pressure normalized, Geoffrey took off his helmet and allowed it to drift down to the floor. "Eidetic scanner," Jumai said, directing his attention to a hoop-like device set just below the ceiling. "And a gene reader in that wall panel under the scanner. You'll need to make skin contact with it." Geoffrey ordered the suit to remove itself. He stepped out wearing just his inner layer, shivering as the coldness of the air touched him for the first time. He positioned himself under the eidetic scanner, remembering the similar device in Charma and Gleb's menagerie. The scanner lowered down until it formed a halo around his head. The device would be primed to respond to visual memories of specific events or locations. It would easily be capable of distinguishing between memories laid down directly and those confabulated from second-hand experience. At the same time, he pressed his bare palm against the grey rectangle of the gene reader. He felt the tingle as the reader drew a representative sample of skin cells.
"State your name,"
a machine-generated voice said in Swahili. He swallowed before answering. "Geoffrey Akinya."
"State your relationship to Eunice Akinya."
"I am her grandson. Please cease attack on the approaching ship. It is not hostile. Repeat, it is not hostile." If the scanner understood his words or cared about them, it gave no sign. The hoop tracked up and down, ghost symbols fluttering across his vision, weird and senseless hieroglyphs in colors that the naked eye could not quite perceive. Yellow blues, red greens. The scanner was pushing deep and intrusive fingers into his skull. It was reading the architecture of his brain, the way a blind person might trace the profile of a human face.
"Visualize the household, Geoffrey Akinya. You are walking through the west wing, away from the garden. It is late afternoon."
Picking one memory out of the thousands he held felt dangerously arbitrary. He tried to focus on the details. The specific and telling texture of things, the gleam of polished flooring, the squeak of it under his shoes, the white plastered walls, the way the light fell on the brown framed cabinets and cases of the private museum, dust in lazy suspension pinned in bars of sunlight, the smell from the kitchen which managed to infiltrate every corner of the household.
"Go to your room."
He walked there rather than simply imagining the transition. He pushed open the door, trying to recall the precise heft of it. He had been in the room recently, at least by his own sense of time, so it was not difficult to bring to mind its dimensions, the simple layout and sparse furnishings.
"Sit on the bed and look around."
He did as he was told, forcing the act of consciousness and continuous recollection, not just bringing to mind disconnected objects and impressions, but replaying the visual scene as a smoothly flowing sequence, his point of view tracking fluidly.
"Focus your attention on the elephants."
He had called them to mind, but only as one element of the room's interior. Then he remembered how the Winter Palace had also narrowed its focus onto the elephants, as if they were a key component in the establishing of his identity. That had merely been a question about his age when he'd received the gift. This was an altogether more intense act of scrutiny. He sensed that to fail in this specific reconstruction would be to fail entirely. Lionheart was holding its breath as he held his. He visualized the elephants. He held them in his mind's eye as six distinct forms, recalling the weight of them, the smoothness of the carved wood in his hands, the sharpness of the tusks against his fingertips, the rough, dark feel of their bases. The elephants were all slightly different, even allowing for their diminishing sizes. He strove to visualize the distinguishing details, the subtle variations of head, ear and trunk postures, the leg positions. He concentrated until the act of sustained recollection was unbearable. The image collapsed. The room evaporated from recall.
"Welcome, Jeffrey Akinya," the voice said. "You have authorization to proceed."
The eidetic scanner slid back towards the ceiling. He removed his palm from the gene reader.
"Cease the attack against the incoming ship," he said again, hoping that the system was sophisticated enough to understand and comply. "It is not hostile." "Approach defenses have been stood down. Do you have further instructions regarding the ship?"
"Give me back comms." Jumai, who still had her helmet on, said,
"Link re-established. Eunice, do you hear us?"
She waited a few moments, listening to the voice at the other end of the link.
"Good. The bombardment should have stopped. I think we've managed to persuade Lionheart we're not a threat. But it's probably best if we keep the ship out of immediate harm's way for the moment. If we can work out how to bring you in under automatic guidance, we'll be in touch."
"Much damage?" Jeffrey asked.
"Nothing that should prevent us from getting home, provided we can find fuel and make some basic repairs. You think it's safe to leave the packs and suits here?"
"Keep your suit on," he advised. "One of us should maintain a link back to the ship. Besides, it's cold."
"You could put your own suit back on.
Or I could walk through that door now and find out why we've been brought here." He clapped his arms against his chest, deciding he could deal with the cold for the time being.
"Guess which one I'm going for."
Jeffrey opened the inner lock and pushed through into the Eisteroid. He was doing his best not to think about Hector. The door led into a reception bay and storage chamber, as large as a warehouse, as deep as a cargo ship's hold. It plunged down many levels below the point where they'd emerged, all filled with racked machine parts and stacked cargo pods, gaudy with primary color paintwork, insignia, and warning labels. There was Akinya property here, as well as products and supplies from companies that Jeffrey felt certain had not existed for decades. The ceiling, a level or so overhead, must have pushed above Lionheart's surface, forming one of the bunker-like structures Jeffrey had seen upon landing. It was windowless, but covered with a matrix of lighting elements. A walkway enclosed in a grilled tube, with numerous hand and footholds, pushed out from a small ledge at the airlock's entrance. The bay was brightly illuminated and smelled showroom clean. From somewhere below came the monk-like chant of generators and heavy-duty life support equipment. The throb worked its way through the grilled walkway, trembling it under the push of his fingers. Walking didn't really work in the Eisteroid's practically non-existent gravity. Jeffrey and Jemai were making long, slow, arcing jumps, pushing back from the curve of the ceiling when they rose too high. Jeffrey was glad to be moving. It was beginning to work the blood back into his limbs and fingers.
"Is this what you are expecting?"
Jemai asked.
"Hector would have known better than me what to expect," Jeffrey said, between breaths. "But if you'd asked me to guess what the inside of one of our mining plants looked like, it wouldn't be far off this. There has to be pressure and warmth for the technicians who come out here once in a blue moon. There have to be machine parts and supplies for the things the robots can't make on their own, or aren't allowed to make. And we know the facility's still working as an ice mine.
Eunice didn't drag us all this way just to inspect the troops."
"No." At the far end of the covered walkway was another door, heavy enough to contain pressure, but not an airlock. It opened as they approached, revealing a cabin-like compartment set with restraints and four buckle-in chairs. It was an elevator, Jeffrey supposed, or what passed for an elevator on a world that was virtually weightless.
"We've come this far," he said in response to Jumai's unspoken question.
They chose seats and buckled in, Jumai having to adjust her restraint to fit around the extra bulk of her suit. Only when they were secure did the door close on them. Jeffrey felt an immediate surge of smooth acceleration. Insofar as he trusted his sense of orientation, it felt as if they were heading down, deeper into Lionheart.
"Eunice?"
Jumai asked, more in hopefulness than expectation. But there was no answer. The elevator sped on, still accelerating. The ride lasted a minute or three, long enough, given their evident speed, to to reach at least a couple of kilometers into the asteroid's interior. It slowed quickly, but it was only when the door opened again that Jeffrey could be sure they had stopped. They pushed out of the elevator into a white room about the size of a small hotel lobby. With its covered corners and bright handrails, it had the modular and utilitarian feel of a piece of spacecraft, transplanted deep underground. Circular doors led off from three of the walls into curving, red-lit corridors. The generator throb was much more prominent now, and the walls displayed a constant succession of scrolling status updates and complicated multicolored diagrams. Nothing he wouldn't have expected in a remotely operated mining facility. That underlying throb might have been the vibration of monstrous drills gnawing ever deeper into the cold husk of this stillborn comet. Or something else. The floor shook. "You feel that?" Jeffrey said. "Package launch," Jemai said. "I felt one earlier, when we were in the tunnel. You must have been airborne when it happened. It seemed to be going off on schedule as before. Business as usual." They both tensed. What they heard were not footsteps, precisely, but the unmistakable approach of something propelling itself limb over limb in the near-weightless conditions. It was coming along one of the red-lit shafts, its busy, bustling sound preceding it. Defenseless, Jeffrey's only response was to find a handhold and reach for it. Jemai made to seal her visor, then drew her hand slowly back before she completed the gesture. The thing was a golem. He could tell that much as it came around the curve. It was humanoid, but it moved with the manic, limb-whirling energy of a gibbon, the quadruped gait too rhythmic and choreographed to look entirely natural. It was tumbling head over heels, yet maintaining impressive forward momentum. Only when the golem neared the door did its movements settle into something more plausibly organic. Sunday's construct had emulated Eunice at the end of her public life, as she had been before going into exile. She'd lived 7 decades by then and taken no great pains to disguise that age. This was different. They were looking at a much younger incarnation now, perhaps half the age of the original construct. The golem had arrived, dressed in a simple one-piece black garment, marked on the sleeves with various flags and emblems. Eunice's hair was long and black, thick without a trace of grey, though she had combed it back from her forehead and gathered it into an efficient bun, secured with a black mesh hairnet. The hairstyle was austere, suited for weightlessness rather than fashion, but the effect on the golem was one of understated and modest elegance. Jeffrey had seen countless images of his grandmother as a young woman, but he had never once thought of her as beautiful. She was, though. Small-boned, long-necked, with prominent cheekbones and wide eyes that cut right through him, and the thing he'd never really detected in all those images, that quiet, knowing smile. He still hated her for what she'd done to Hector, which was ridiculous, of course. This wasn't Eunice, even if it was convenient to think of the golem as such. Yet he had to remind himself of that.
"I always hoped it might be you, Jeffrey," she said,
casting a long and appraising glance over him. She had come to rest standing up, her feet on the floor.
"I didn't count on it, and it wouldn't have mattered if someone else came instead. They'd have been tested as well, and if they were blood Akinias with strong ties to the household, I don't doubt that they'd have passed the eidetic scan just as capably."
He had too many questions to know where to start.
"The only reason I'm here is because Hector and Lucas decided to ask me to investigate the safe deposit box. If they'd sent someone else to do that, you'd be talking to them now."
"But would anyone else have had the fortitude to come this far?"
She cocked her head.
"I extracted some of your memories during the eidetic scan. Unethical, but it had to be done. I know something of what you've been through, and I'm sorry that it was necessary."
"She's bullshitting," Jemai said. "Eidetic scans can't extract and process memories that easily. They look for correlations with known image patterns. They can't just rummage through your head indiscriminately like someone searching a sock drawer. Machines just don't have the intelligence to make sense of the raw data.
You'd need something with Artilect level condition at the very...
Then it's a good job there's an Artilect running me,
Eunice said, cutting her off with savage discourtesy. Not one of those modern declawed weaklings either. Military grade, more than 80 years old, fully Turing compliant. The kind of thing that the Cognition Police was set up to pulverize.
Should you have told us that? Jeffrey asked. Or are you not planning on us ever going home again?
No, you can go home. I'll put no constraints on that. I'd be a very ungracious host otherwise, wouldn't I? There's fuel here, and the damage to your ship is nothing that can't be fixed, given Lionheart's resources.
For an Artilect, you are pretty slow to realize we meant no harm,
Jemai said.
I'm but one facet of the Artilect, Eunice said, and I was only activated after you had already established your credentials. Until then, Lionheart was guarding itself as it has done for more than 60 years. If certain autonomic vigilance protocols acted with excessive zeal, then you must forgive me.
If you've read my memory, you'll know that you killed one of us, Jeffrey said.
I didn't pick that up, Eunice said.
And for a moment, there was something like contrition in her tone.
It must have happened very shortly before the scan. The memories hadn't had time to cross the hippocampus to be encoded into long-term storage. If there were casualties...
You killed Hector, Jemai told her. He was your grandson as well.
She shook her head in self-disgust.
What am I doing? Trying to make an Artilect feel guilty. She's only a mask. Behind her is just stuff.
Are you finished? Eunice asked. I apologized. I did not mean it to happen. But the stakes have always been high, impossibly so. Do you think any of this was done without good reason?
I have no idea what any of this is other than a means of wasting time and killing innocent people, Jeffrey said. We'll add Memphis to that tally as well. He'd be alive if I hadn't been dragged into your fun and games.
Memphis is dead?
The golem looked away, as if there was something on Eunice's face that she did not wish them to see.
I didn't know, she added,
in a softer voice than she'd used so far.
When did it happen?
Jeffrey was about to say that it had only been a few days ago, but then he remembered the time he had spent traveling to Lionheart. 7 weeks ago, there was an accident with the elephants.
If his death was a consequence of my actions, I can't begin to tell you how that makes me feel.
You don't feel anything, Jemai said.
You're wrong about me, the golem told her. This had to be done. Don't you understand?
We don't, Jeffrey said.
You came all this way. Surely you must have an inkling of what this is all about by now.
She searched their faces for a glimmer of comprehension.
You don't know anything, do you?
My sister said you'd spoken of a gift, something that was both a blessing and a curse, Jeffrey said.
Yes.
Eunice nodded keenly.
Yes, there was a gift, and you must know about the jewels to have made it this far, and the engine that brought you to Lionheart. Surely that can't have escaped your attention. You made the connection, obviously?
The engine's better than anything else out there, Jeffrey said. It got us to trans-Neptunian space in weeks rather than months. Is that what this is all about?
No, Eunice said before adding, well, yes, in one sense. But the engine was only a means of bringing you here and of demonstrating my, shall we say, sincerity.
She smiled encouragingly.
So that whatever else I do or show you, you'll have good grounds to take my words at face value.
Every commercial interest in the system is going to want to pick that thing apart, Jeffrey said. And suddenly Hector was speaking through him. The ship may be a Kenya space property, but we won't be able to sit on a secret like that forever.
You won't have to. I've already made provisions for the engine. And keep in mind that while I live and breathe, I am still running this firm.
Jeffrey sneered. I hate to break it to you, but the only reason we're here is because you upped and died at the end of last year.
You and I need a word, Eunice said.